Hey, I'm Jeffrey Masters, and this is LGBTQ and A. Today's interview is a really fantastic reminder, I think, that it is impossible to separate out LGBTQ history from world history. Our guest is Mia Yamamoto. She was born in 1943 in a Japanese internment camp in Arizona. This was during World War II. Then in the 60s, she enlisted and went to fight for the U.S. in Vietnam. That was despite, I should say, being against the war. After she returned, Mia became a criminal defense attorney and civil rights activist in Los Angeles. And then 2 decades ago now, this is the day she turned 60, Mia finally decided, okay, I cannot wait any longer. She came out then and started to live and work openly as a trans woman. Mia joins us today to talk about all that. She is 80 years old and still a practicing attorney. So without further ado, this is LGBT Q&A with Mia Yamamoto. So I just want to start at the beginning. You were born in and spent the first few years of your life in a Japanese internment camp. When, for yourself, did you realize that that was not normal, for lack of better words? I ask it like that just because when you're young and growing up, like, your home is your home. That's your normal, right?
I left the camps when I was 2 years old, so I have no memory of the camps at all. I have memory of the resettlement because we all came back en masse in 1945, 46, 47. I remember those years, and my parents told me a lot about the camps. They were trying to explain that's why everybody was so hostile when we came back. People were not real happy about us coming back, particularly the people that wanted us gone in the first place. So there was a lot of animosity or bigotry or whatever you want to call it, a lot of hatred against us, even from other minorities. So that was an interesting experience.
So the camps were something that, like, your family, like, talked about and was discussing. It wasn't something you, like, they ignored and never talked about again.
No, my mom talked about it. My father never talked about it. He wasn't a very talkative man, even though he was a lawyer. But my mother talked about it quite a bit, actually. She told me a lot of stories about the camp. Most people, you're right, did not want to talk about it. They felt some measure of shame about having to just get out of prison. And they wanted to put the experience behind them. So a lot of them just did not want to talk about it any further to get on with the future.
Yeah. You said you experienced a lot of racism when you, like, moved back. You moved back to Southern California, right?
Yeah, East LA.
What did that racism look like?
Well, it was like... It was, if you're walking on the street, there was sort of open season on Japanese people. They would just jump you. I would be walking on the street towards school and some kids would jump out of the place and say, "Kill the Japs," and all of a sudden they'd be on me. And the real problem with it was it really made you not want to be Japanese. You know what I mean? That's but the last thing that you wanted to be. You don't want to speak the language. You certainly don't want to wear anything that looked like it might have been somebody from Japan, any of that kind of thing. You sort of avoided that when you were on the streets. It was a very vulnerable feeling. And I think it's one of the reasons why kids band together for self-protection when these things are happening. I mean, the community was the community, and we were unified by virtue of our sort of our common exclusion. Camp was such a unifying experience. It was a horrible experience, but it was just the kind of thing like that every kid my age would always ask, you know, which camp were you in? One of those conversation starters. You know, "Oh, did you know so-and-so or so-and-so and blah, blah, blah."
Oh, you're saying that if you saw another, like, Japanese person, like, that was, like, how you bonded, like, what camp you were in.
Right. "Oh, you're Japanese. What camp are you in?"
That's wild. And so when you were growing up in East LA after the camp, how were you thinking about your, like, gender back then?
Well, by the time I was 5 years old, which is just a really not that many years after I was born, actually, I started to realize the disconnect. That I could see the world a certain way. And I had 3 older brothers, and they were completely, absolutely different from me. I couldn't stand them. They were violent. I thought very, very primitive sorts of people, I thought. You know what I mean? I didn't even know there were trans people in the world at that time. I had no idea. It was one of those concepts that was just, I had no name for it. I just knew that there was a disconnect. I knew that I looked at the world a certain way, and I actually found that the girls had that much more in common with me, whereas the boys didn't look at the world the same way, didn't have priorities like mine, didn't appreciate things the way I did. And even their connections with other people were always a lot more I grew up in a gang neighborhood. We were all gang kids, all of us, at least Los Angeles at the time, poor kids. We were rejected from every community, though. We were not accepted in any community, not in the Latino community, not in the white community, not in the black community. We were completely excluded. So that experience of being just sort of, kind of sequestered in its own way.
And so are you saying, too, that in like the post-war era, like your Japanese identity was so, you know, like big in people's minds, too, and so strong that that kind of like superseded any other identity, even like your like budding transness?
Yes, I would say that it superseded it in the sense that when we came out of camp, the big theme was fitting back in. The last thing they wanted me to do was to express my femininity.
Oh, wait, who is they? Is it your parents?
My parents, yes. And I would think, you know, it wasn't just my parents. It was the whole community. I actually went to an all-Japanese-American school and church. It was segregated very purposely because of the animosity that existed outside of the community. So we were sequestered in that sense. So, yeah, I mean, it wasn't just my parents. It was a whole lot of parents and a whole lot of a church community and a school community. And for people to bring shame to their family was bad enough. But from the family's point of view, to bring shame to your community was a lot worse because that made the family sort of lowered their status in the community as well.
And gave you like another like reason not to fit in almost, right?
Yes. So gender conformity became something that I really understood early and I understood the need for very early.
Were you like good at it or were you seen as like feminine from like the outside world?
I was great at it. Jeez, I got to the point where I was an expert. You know, I think I was probably the most accomplished closet queen probably in the city.
And so in the 60s, you enlisted and went to Vietnam to fight in the war. What made you want to do that?
Oh, are you kidding? Part of it was two things. One, I mean, I've always been sort of, I guess, patriotic in that sense. I always wanted to serve my country. But the other part of it was the Japanese-American community. We were in camp, and while we were in camp, there was a group called the 442, which is an all-Japanese army regiment that distinguished itself in Europe. So when they came back, a lot of people, my parents included, felt like they redeemed us, that they showed their loyalty, their sacrifice, that we were loyal, which was the big question during the course of our incarceration. So I felt like the military was a really important thing for me to do. My parents were really imbued with that. You fight for your country. That's how you gain your measure of acceptance, was you fight for your country. And that you have to understand the context. I was living a very tortured life. At that time, it was horrible to be in the closet, to be suppressing my identity. So I felt very tortured, very, very unhappy, very suicidal. So going into the military, joining the military and going to Vietnam was an honorable exit from a troubled life. I felt like that would be a way out.
Oh, it's a passive way of killing yourself.
Exactly.
In a way.
It was, in its own way. I was young at the time. I didn't really understand the implications of all that. I just understood that if I lost my life in battle, then my family would never be ashamed of me.
Oh, you would never have to come out.
Yes.
But you also, spoiler alert, didn't die in Vietnam. Once you were there, like you weren't like throwing yourself in the line of fire. Like, did your feelings change when you were there?
When I went in the military, I just did what I was told. I did what every other soldier does. And it's part of the culture, too. You don't ask questions about when you're ordered to do something. You just do it. And that was also, to me, part of the community and part of the ethos of being a soldier.
So we have to go back, though, for a second. I'm so surprised by you talking about the like patriotism that you feel and your family feels. It just strikes me so odd having like been forced into this internment camp as a child, your family there, and yet your family and you were still patriots, still wanted to fight for your country. Can you like connect that feeling?
Yeah, but it was really very understandable. If you saw the reverence that my community had for the soldiers and for the honor they had brought to the community, then being a soldier was the most natural thing in the world. And my parents were very much, I feel, socialized into that because my father had died by the time we went to the service. He died when I was very young. But my mother, I'm telling you, this is a true story. She said to me, I don't want you to ever be a coward. She said, I would rather you came home dead than you come home a coward. And I kind of, I still live like that. You can't live like a, you can't be a coward in this world. You got to live your life with courage. And I had no problem with that. I mean, especially I had no fear of death, for one thing. So it wasn't that big of a deal to me.
And so just to like generalize, but for the like Japanese people you knew back then, like they had no problem also going to fight in this war.
Don't forget, I was born in camp, but by the time I went in the military, I was already like 20, 21, 22 years old. So I had lived a whole couple of decades in my own right. And I knew what I valued and what I didn't value. And I thought that that was service to your country. And I know it sounds kind of strange because I'm a total radical revolutionary that way, but I still feel like everything I do is in service to this country and in service to my fellow Americans, that we're always trying to make this thing better and, you know, more evolved and, you know, more progressive and all that sort of stuff. But all this stuff couldn't come without sacrifice. So I always feel like this is the theme and this is the way forward. Honestly, I mean, when you're 21 years old and the war's going on and people telling you got to serve your country, you just go. And your family's telling you that you got to go, you got to go. You know, it's like when your country calls you, you go. You don't sit there and say, well, I don't know if I like it very much or not. I hated the war before I went in. I'm not going to lie. I don't like the war. I was old enough. I had been to college. I wasn't completely stupid, not like some of my colleagues there. I realized how bad it was, how evil it was, but my country was there and wow. They were fighting and I couldn't not be there.
Your reasons to join the war, how much also had to do with like your gender and like wanting them to like make you a man?
Exactly.
More or less.
I mean, I felt like that was another thing too, is proving myself not just to the world and my society and my family, but to myself that I could do this thing, that I had what it takes to get out there with a gun and fight. I always knew I could fight with my fists. That was something I was always game to do. But getting out there with a gun, that's serious business. There's, you know, that means somebody's going to die. Hopefully it ain't you. You know, so I could share this with you. I really never had any fear of death. I really didn't at the time. I felt like it was an honorable exit, like I said, from a very, very, very troubled life that I was trying to get out of anyway. So that factor never came up. But really, I just did my time, got out. On one level, it was just going in the military. Not everybody I knew at the time. A lot of people were against the war. A lot of people were going to Canada. A lot of people were fighting the draft. I wouldn't do it. I refused to do that. I felt like that was cowardly. You know, and again, my mom, like she said, I'd rather see you dead than see you a coward. She said a lot of things in my life that I hearken back upon. I remember she said something once that never left me when I was very young. She said, if I ever hear about you running from a fight, you'll have to come home and fight your brothers.
Did she get that from her own parents, like that? Those like thoughts?
I don't know where she got that, but I remember her telling me that when I was very young. And don't forget, my brothers are like 8 and 10 years older than me, you know. And when you're like 5 years old, fighting with a 15-year-old or a 17-year-old, that ain't a fight, man. That's a slaughter.
So how much of that like fight mentality made you want to go to like law school to like fight in that way, like as a lawyer?
No, my dad was a lawyer. My dad had graduated from law school in 1928. Spent his whole career in the segregated bar. He died when I was very young. But one thing I did learn about my dad was he helped people all the time. He lived his whole life sacrificing financially and all kinds of other ways to make sure that he was of service to people that needed his help. And that legacy is something I'm very proud to carry. Yeah, so being a lawyer that way, that's a family tradition.
Law school is a intense experience, but also PTSD is intense. I don't know if you had experience with PTSD, but were you dealing with that at the same time you were in law school?
But I'm still dealing with it. It's really awful, but it still affects me today. You know, like 50, 60 years later, I still jump out of my seats. People think it's funny, and I guess it is, but it was, at the time, extraordinarily stressful because it takes you a couple of seconds to kind of like calm down and realize you know, it's not something that you have to react to. And that, I have to say, I like to think it's getting smaller over the course of time, but I feel like it's still there. I still have that. I still have that amazing, just that reaction, just immediately. It's like, it's completely visceral. It is not something that goes through my head. It's just something that it happens and you jump. So there's almost no way for me I was in therapy for a long time, believe me, dealing with a lot of those struggles. But it's not, you know, really, it's today is pretty harmless, I feel. It's not harming me in any real way, I don't think.
And you've described your work as a public defender as the most important thing you ever did. Why is that?
Us working for the poor. I mean, us fighting for the poor. I always tell people that, you know, fighting for the poor is still the highest calling for any lawyer. If you're going to answer a calling, it seems to me that trying to make things more equal, trying to make things more fair, and really trying to minister to the needs of the people that are the most needy people in society is still the highest calling for a lawyer. It's still the thing that absolutely makes me tick, in the sense that, you know, I see that happening and I feel like it just gets me going. Basically, the unfairness of a situation is not something I could turn my back on.
When you say fighting for the poor, like what types of like cases and clients were they?
Well, I had everything. I mean, I was a PD for 10 years. I'm still a criminal lawyer, still what I do. So it's really basically still the same clientele, essentially. I look at how little they have and how little they've ever had in terms of their lives and how they get to where they get. And some of them go pretty far despite all the adversity. But some people it just beats them down and they never quite crawl their way out of it. And they often need a champion, somebody who really understands that, who sympathizes with it, who has some empathy for their life, and can walk into a courtroom and fight everybody over the issues that have to be fought. I just feel like, I'm really lucky, because so many people get that kind of, you know, emotional and spiritual satisfaction out of fighting. You
know? And I read too that you were working, some of your clients were queer and trans people. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that was the most interesting thing, because I really, in many ways, until I was a lawyer, until I was a public defender, I never really understood how the community was treated by the police. I really never understood that. And when I was working in the juvenile court, I remember representing trans kids. And I remember looking at them and thinking, they got kicked out of their house when they were like 12, 13, because the parents didn't like the way they dressed. And they would be on my caseload, and they're just little kids. And they're busted for things like, there's people that were trying to use you at that age out there in the streets, and they would be busted for stealing, for dealing narcotics, for selling their bodies. They would be doing anything they could on behalf of their sponsor, whoever that is, their pimp, and they would end up on my caseload. And I would try to get them home. Anybody who works in juvenile court, reunification of the families is always a very important objective, the goal. I would try to get him to go back home, and the mom would tell me, I can't take him home. His father has promised me that he will kill him if he comes in the door again. His brothers have promised that they will help him. They will help my father kill him. And I can't take him home. He's got to go to a home. He's got to go to a foster home. He can't come back, or else he's dead. So the plight of that 12 or 13-year-old, that still kind of gets me. It's just so tragic and so sad. And these kids are so brave. The thing that struck me was, these kids are coming out 13, 14 years old, something I had absolutely no way that I would have ever been able to do. That I would have mustered the courage to stand up and say, I want to wear a dress. And I don't care what happens when I do.
I mean, it was also, though, just a different time when you were growing up in the 40s and 50s. I mean, do you remember the first time you heard the word transgender or transsexual even?
The first time I ever heard that word, transvestite, was in the movie Psycho. And at the end of the movie, this expert's sitting around trying to figure out what this guy is, makes him tick. And they say, well, he's obviously a transvestite. I remember looking at that and thinking, well, what's in the dictionary, you know? And I guess because I was in high school at the time, I couldn't go very far with it, but I was going to the dictionary, going to the encyclopedia and all kinds of other places trying to figure that out. And when I went to college, I was in every medical school library. I was in every single library, psychology department of every single school I was ever in. I would be in there for hours and days and weeks trying to figure out what the fuck went wrong with me. You know, I'd find all these terms. I found transsexual. I mean, even though the first time it was applied to me was my second or third therapist who came to that conclusion about me after testing me.
And how old were you about?
I had to be in my mid to late 20s.
Okay.
I was finally making enough money to go into therapy and to see a shrink. And So I was learning about all these things at that time, but it was also still a revelation.
And so this therapist tells you you're likely trans in your 20s. You came out at 60, though. Were you taking those like 30, 40 years just to like grapple with it in your head? Like what was going on in your mind?
Well, I fired that therapist that told me that. I said, you know, I came here looking for a cure. I'm paying you for a cure. And if you can't find me a cure, you can at least give me what the cause is. Because if I can find a cause, I can create a cure. I said, you can't give me either. You're fired. I didn't understand until maybe 10 or 20 years later when I was in group therapy. And when I was in group therapy, I met all these other people who had kids and married. They were in jobs. They were in careers. That every single one of them was in great jeopardy because the family was in jeopardy. Their marriage was in jeopardy. Their relationship with the kids and everybody else they knew was in jeopardy. And I made certain decisions about my life based upon that. I'm never going to get married, never going to have kids. I was never going to drag some other human being through my problems that way because it was just seemed so humiliating for their families and especially for the wife. I mean, she had not signed on for this.
You had a lot of really negative examples of trans people. Your clients, they're struggling, facing incarceration, these people in group therapy. I mean, is that how you just assumed your life would end up if you transitioned?
I wasn't sure. I knew I didn't want to live that life that they were living and that I didn't want to live the life I was living. If you think about it for a second, that's the reason why it took me so long to come out. I was 60 years old when I came out, and it took me that long to come to the one single revelation was that the real shame was not being trans. It was being fake. It was not being authentic. It was not being truthful. It was being a phony and a coward and all the things I really kind of don't like about people. So I knew I couldn't continue like that. I had to take whatever consequences came from it.
And so what was that moment that you decided I'm going to do this?
I remember the moment I was singing a song. I was playing a benefit for some progressive cause and a proposition, something I can't remember, in somebody's backyard. And I'm playing this gig and people are coming up and blah, blah, blah. And I've got my guitar with me and I'm singing with my nephews. All of a sudden people said, oh, it's a surprise birthday party. You're 60 years old and blah, blah, blah. And I was sitting there thinking, As these people are all making nice with me, basically congratulating me, all that sort of stuff. But I remember thinking at the time, how would you like it if I killed that dude? It went through my head. That was the words that went through my head. And I just said, no, I refuse to live like this. I don't know of a single trans trial lawyer for sure, because I was on the courts every day. And it got to the point where it just didn't matter. I was kind of hoping that the world would be more open to it someday, but I knew I'm 60. I already lived a whole life in complete stealth, and I'm thinking that you threw your life away. You lived a fucking fake life. You know, how can you continue with that? And so I just started coming out to people, and most people thought I was completely insane. So many people thought I was joking. It was just another gag. You know what I mean?
I think that coming out at any age has its own challenges, and I don't think one's easier than the other. But I do think it's a really specific and compelling just to come out at 60, because you have 60 years of proof, in other people's minds, and someone else's mind, to be like, what do you mean? Of course not.
Yeah, but the fact of the matter is, I got a whole variety of responses from that. But my best friends, I remember the ones that because it's interesting to do something like that. Coming out is really a fascinating exercise in relationships, because my favorite response was the people that said to me, it's a fucked up world that you couldn't have come out sooner.
Wow.
That was the one that got me. But, you know, coming out trans is different than coming out lesbian or gay. It's much more in your face. You're going to look a lot different tomorrow after you come out.
So in terms of your work and how it impacted your work and your clients as a lawyer, what did you expect would happen and what actually did happen?
I expected to lose everything, lose everybody and everything. I expected it. I looked around. I could see the animosity that people had. You look around the world, you look around the courts, you look around where I work and the people that I associate with, bar associations, community organizations, jails, prisons, prosecutor's offices, and primarily the courthouse. where it's a very public place. So I figured I would lose everything, and it was okay. I remember I got to that point in my life, I said, you know, something that's way more important for me is just come out. When I first came out to my clients, I mean, they're really an important high priority for me because that's my responsibility. I came out to each one of them individually, went to the jails, and I said, I'm going to be going through a gender change, a sex change, and I know that's not what you signed on for. I said, and if you can't manage that, I said, I know some of the best lawyers in Southern California. You will be well taken care of. And I appreciate that this is a shock, and it was to almost all of them. And many of my clients were murder clients and gang members, and they have certain cultural issues with LGBT people.
Yeah.
And I thought for sure that I would lose most of them. I lost none of them, zero. Every person had a different reaction. Well, they all had the same reaction at first. They all said, no shit, man. You're really going to do that? That was exactly. But then I said, then they would say something like, well, why would I want somebody else besides you? And one of them said, you know, I didn't hire you for your brain. You know, these guys are pretty tough guys, but I didn't lose a single one of them. And they all wanted to stick with me, even after I gave them the open saying that, you know, I will find somebody to represent you. I will continue with this. I'll make sure you're taken care of. So the clients were awesome, I thought. Just amazing, really. To this day, I'm still moved to tears by how embracing they were of me, because I didn't expect that at all. Not from them. There's some tough, hardcore guys, man. It was like,
what did it feel like to walk into court that first time, like presenting as a woman?
Well, you know, it's interesting. The night before that, I remember I got my clothes ready and I was getting ready to go dress for the first time. And I remember saying to myself, I'm going to liberate the criminal courts building. I'm going to force them to experience something that they will never, ever be able to unsee. And the landscape will change. And it won't be comfortable for me. People are going to be shocked. But it's going to be a good thing that I'm going to do. I'm going to liberate the courthouse. I'm going to liberate the jail. I'm going to liberate the prosecutor's office. I'm going to liberate all these places that have never seen a transgender trial lawyer before in their life. And I remember that was the motivation I needed, that this was something noble I was going to do, something really progressive and liberating. And I remember saying that to myself before I went. It was like, okay, it's time to liberate the criminal courts building. But first time I went to court, it was like jaws dropping, eyes popping. Many people not even know what the hell to say to me, you know, or people asking me if I'm crazy, you know what I mean? What the fuck are you doing? That kind of a thing. But then when I walked into court for the first time, the DA looks at me and she's up and down. She goes, so what do we call you now? And I said, that's a perfect question. I said, I call myself Mia. That's my name. And I appreciate you even asking me that. And she was great. I mean,
And so you came out as trans, as like a big label. Did you also like have to start then identifying as a lesbian too?
I did. And what was really interesting was, I mean, I was a type of person, believe me, I took advantage of being a male. I had a great time being in relationships with women. However, they were always very limited because I knew that I was going to be going through transition. I knew where I was headed and I could never stick with those relationships. I had some very great loving relationships. And I remember looking at them thinking, God, if I wasn't trans, I could have such a great life with these wonderful women. So, you know, yeah, and the weird thing about being trans is that I'm a straight male, I'm a lesbian trans woman, but in no instance am I attracted to males at all. And yet that's the only people that I got attention from after I transitioned. So now I'm a flaming lesbian, I have to say. You
know. And you're a married woman now too.
Yes, I am. Yeah, I thought I was never going to get married, but you know, I turned 70. I thought I dodged it. I'm never going to get married. And fine with me. I like being by myself. I've lived with it a long time. There's a lot of advantages to being totally single. And I'm not the type of person to get lonely because I have so many friends. I have so many activities that I've been playing in bands for like, you know, almost 40 years now. So I have a big social circle and a huge progressive community that I do a lot of work out in the community as advocacy stuff. So I never felt, but then, you know, somebody came along when I was 72, 73 and wanted to get married. So we're married. It's that way. And it's fine. You know, I mean, I go through as many struggles as any other married person, believe me. We fight like crazy, but I still love her dearly. Yeah. So yeah, I am married. I never thought I would be. I never thought I wanted to be. whoever would have predicted that? Whoever, I would have never predicted that I would have made it to 80. Never. I figured no way in the world was I going to get past 40. I figured I'd be either way. If I didn't kill myself, somebody was going to kill me.
That was depression talking, you're saying?
No, it was just realism. You know, in this life, I was going to have much of a life, and it was probably going to end very early. And because of that, I made no provisions for old age. It's like, oh my God.
Are you worried about like aging and getting older?
No, I don't worry about that. I don't worry about stuff like that. Matter of fact, I'm still working. I'm still working full time. I still see people that need my help. I'm not going to stop doing that. So I feel like it's kind of an experiment. You know, at this age, yeah, I'm not going to be around too much longer, probably, I don't know. But I want to be able to be productive and helping people and whatever for as long as I can.
It's so interesting that you are working with queer and trans people early in your career. Usually people like, you know, run as far away from as like the thing that scares them as possible. But you actually were like in the closet and like helping the trans community.
I was helping the queer community too. As a matter of fact, all the time I was working in coalitions, working with bar associations, I wanted to make sure that everything that we did, we never excluded the LGBT community. They always saw me as this great ally, and they didn't realize I was a member of the community for all those years. But I was always fighting for the community long before it was fashionable. I would go to law student groups, and kids would come up to me and say, "You're the first leader we've ever seen advocate for gay people." They said, and they were very, very, they were just dazzled by that. You know, when you're the kind of person I mean, you're kind of a rebel, you have no problem advocating for despised communities. Matter of fact, I feel very proud to do that. I feel like, you know, if it takes no courage at all to support popular positions. The idea of gay inclusion, particularly at the bar at one time, was considered radical. It was considered radical advocacy. Today, it's necessary. It's just part of being equitable in society, is making sure that you got room for everybody.
I know for many years you worked fighting against the death penalty. What is your like focus now? Like what's your big mission at the moment?
Well, I'm still against the death penalty. And I still think it cheapens and harms all of us morally. But right now, I think I'm far more involved with, or currently, I'm much more of an advocate for LGBT people. And that is my biggest audience. I just spoke to an audience of 2,100 Asian American lawyers for the National Association of Asian Pacific Lawyers in Indianapolis, talked to the California attorneys, consumer attorneys of California 2 days ago. And in each of my speeches, I talk about the need to support the community. And I talk about the ways we're being attacked. I talk about the fact that they've got to be allies. They can't just be standing on the sidelines and say, "Oh, that's too bad." Because being an ally is obligation of every single person of conscience. Because when you see an injustice someplace close to you, if you don't do something about it, then to me, you're part of the problem.
I mean, most of the battles we're fighting now like are in like the courtroom, right? Especially the trans youth are being like attacked in state houses. We're on defense in like a major way. Do you think that we're doing like something wrong? Like, should we be like playing offense in a specific way? Should we be doing like something else? Like, what do you think about that?
I think the advocacy has to be to the non-trans and non-LGBT community. We have to actually be seeking out allies. I often quote from Frederick Douglass, who said that when he fought against slavery, it was for himself. When he fought against racial discrimination, it was for his people. But when he fought for the rights of women, he found some nobility there. And I think that's the whole point of it, is that what I've learned in the course of this advocacy is that there's a group called Parents and Friends of Lesbians and Gays, and they are very open and vocal in support of their kids. And I've watched them over the course of the past 30 years, and I realized they are more powerful and more persuasive in the public forum than I could ever be for myself. The people that love us, and therefore, being an ally is the hugest, biggest thing I can be advocating for out there on the streets, is what I do in every one of these speeches I'm talking about. Be an ally. Stand up for communities that are being oppressed, because that is where you find some nobility. It isn't in your self-interest. It's for the people that you love. And in many ways, it's all about love. it's all about love. It's all about love of each other, love of justice and love of equality and love of people. And this whole thing about, I have a focus on support the parents of trans kids, because they're the ones who are being attacked, and those are the ones that have the voices that will ultimately liberate all of us. No minority movement is ever going to succeed without allies. So that's my take on it.
I think that's a great place to end it. Thank you for spending so much time.
Oh, no, it's my pleasure.
And that is Mia Yamamoto. Next week, we will return with a pre-Stonewall activist. That's Martha Shelley. She was a member of some of our community's most legendary activist groups. I'm thinking about the Daughters of Bilitis and the Gay Liberation Front. Here's a small preview of her talking about Stonewall.
To me, the important thing about Stonewall is not that there was a riot, because there had been, I think, at least one other gay riot on the West Coast. But nothing happened in terms of organizing after that. The important thing about Stonewall was that we organized. Throwing bottles or bricks or whatever at a few cops, getting arrested, going home, that doesn't change the world. What changes the world is organizing.
That's Martha Shelley, and that full interview will be coming out next Tuesday. In the meantime, if you enjoy our podcast, please help us to spread the word about the show. Leave a comment on Apple Podcasts, text your friends, post about us on social media, post about us on social media twice. All of those things really are super important when it comes to helping our show continue to grow. And also, there is a link in our bio to our Substack. That is another great way, if you're able, to help support our show and ensure that we can continue putting out episodes for years to come. We have been making the show and recording these stories since 2016, but the truth is, we cannot do it without your help. So if you are able to, there is a link in our bio to our Substack. Thank you, thank you, thank you so much to everyone who has joined us there. All right, that's it for me. I'm Jeffrey Masters. I will see you next Tuesday. Bye.